White Noise Podcast. We show entertainment stuff. Billy and Seth, David and Billy, and David and Seth, and Billy again. This is the best show in the entire world. Movies, TV, video games. Enjoy the show.
Hello everyone, welcome to the White Noise Weekly, episode number 15 on the White Noise Podcast. I'm your host, Billy White, and joining me is Seth Juniak, a.k.a. Seth Jelaiak. Get it? Jelaiak.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it was great yesterday, too.
Hey, I just came with that right now at this exact moment. What are you talking about?
Oh, gosh, you're not even going to give credit where credit's due. You're horrible, man.
So Brian, who does, you know, the video game podcast, I think he's the one who came up with that joke. I love it, and I may start doing that from now on.
I like this joke. Oh, great. It's mine now.
Hey, that's exactly how every great comedian does things, Seth. No one's that original. Except for, like, Louis C.K., whose stuff's too dark and hilariously awful, you know, in terms of, like, the material he uses. That. Everything else, though, is stolen from someone else, I imagine. Not much is original nowadays.
I mean, yeah, but still, you know... We have to at least, you know, say that the way society is wrong, and instead of being part of the filth.
I don't know what you're talking about. I think society is great. Sure. I wish you could see my cheesy smile and thumbs up thing I just made. Like, you know, in Community,
yeah.
Or like there's like that the video they have for the community, the average, like, go Green Dell, go, and they do like the little arm loop thing and it ends in a thumbs up. That's what I just did. I can't be possibly sure if you know exactly what that reference is, but I'm sure some people watch Community. I'm talking about. Anyway,
I mean, I watch Community, and I kind of know what you're talking about, but, you know, I'm smiling, just going, yeah.
So Dave is not here with us today. He is a big Jurassic Park fan, as we all know, so he's now trying to recreate his own fan version of what he wants Jurassic World 2 to be.
There's like a... You know, the CDC in Atlanta, he's, like, injecting himself with dinosaur genes to see what happens.
He's trying to get inside the mind of a dinosaur, right? So he can really understand the process.
Yeah, something like that.
So, because we've been doing other things like the Hall of Fame, you know, Halfway Point, we haven't dived back into these last two episodes of True Detective. And I think it's great that Dave is not here, because David's one of the biggest True Detective fans I know. And he would not be happy about, you know, some of the thoughts and comments we may have today after watching the third episode.
Yeah, the general consensus around the internet is that this one was kind of a mixed episode. You know, some may like it, some may, you know, love it, others might be just kind of lukewarm on it. And I'm not sure where exactly on the spectrum I am, but this was kind of weak, I thought. I mean, not that last season was, you know, had me completely hooked at this time last season. But, like, even then, I saw enough, and, you know, right now I'm starting to see the seams kind of busting apart with True Detective, and, you know, I kind of tip the cap that they embraced some of the weirder things and some of the better, quote-unquote, better things that make this series, and what, you know, Nick Pizzolatto playing to his strength, so to speak. You know, the dream sequences, the occultish stuff, the gigolo, you know, the mayor's house. I mean, those are stuff that play to his strengths, but... You know, for the most part, I mean, it kind of, you know, we're starting to see just how non-fleshed out some of the characters are and just how weak everything is as a whole, I think.
Yeah, I think, I'm kind of with you because I think certain elements work really well. And I always like getting to the positives before we get to the negatives. I think that's to become less of a cynical, you know, viewer or critic. I'm going to try to focus on the positive first before we get what's wrong with it. But I did love the opening. You know, you had the Conway Twitty... what was the song? The Rose?
Yeah.
You know,
it's
the
impersonator. It's a Bette Midler song.
So. Yeah, so you had that. I thought that was pretty good, you know, and then you had, you know, the Velcro scene with his father. As you saw from later on, like, that was kind of like the vision of what he wanted, I guess, his cop father to be while being in the bar right there. You know, it's kind of interesting sequence. I'm still kind of, like, iffy about the whole... Which we haven't talked about this, so I was upset with the ending of last episode because I thought it was complete, like, he was going to live and they just wanted to make it seem like he died for, like, dramatic, you know, false dramatic tension, in my opinion. You know, the way they did that cliffhanger. So I didn't like the way that whole thing was set up. Anyways, I'm glad Velcro is alive because he's the main character, I guess, in my terms of, like, what I'm interested in, what's, you know, hooked me thus far. And like I said, I enjoyed, you know, watching the, you know, guy in the bird mouth. That whole sequence when Velcro got shot was great. And I love the opening here. But it's got to be more than just individual moments that really makes this. You know, I love the acting in certain elements. I like the way Paul Ruggiero's character, you know, he had some of the more interesting moments in this episode. But the main issue is I feel like there's a lot of interesting parts, but as a whole, nothing really seems tied together. Nothing really seems that interesting as a whole. Like, I don't know what the overall arcing storyline is to a certain extent at this point.
Yeah, no, they've kind of hinted at some overarching story by throwing names at us. You know, this Catalyst, this Porpoise, this, you know, I don't know, a Goliath National Bank. I don't know, whatever you want to call it. This looming presence. they keep talking about how something's coming. And, like, I still don't know what Catalyst is. It's been in every episode, and, you know, maybe I can Google it. But it's just like, why should I have to Google it? You know, I should understand what this is. And I don't even know. You're absolutely right that there doesn't seem to be a bigger picture right now.
Also, it's like, okay, you know, Simeon's so upset about, you know, Stan's murder and freaking out about it. Like, who's Stan? I don't really know. Still, like,
the guy with the blue skier cap.
Yeah, whatever. Like, you know, it's like, okay. Stan, come here, Stan. I just think of the one scene in the World of Warcraft episode where, like, he's at the Best Buy and he's like, oh.
Yeah, he's like dying at the.
See, that moment right there brings me, that one singular scene in South Park is probably more enjoyable than this show in terms of the dark, depressing, you know, tone, the underlying mission, what they have going for it.
And look, some people get off on that. I like kind of more balanced, you know, I'm more of a dramedy guy than I am a comedy guy, you know, or more than a drama guy, I guess, but like, I don't know. I mean, there's time and place for drama, but you know, even the great dramas out there, like Mad Men, like Breaking Bad. I mean, there's always some humor splashed in, and True Detective is just, it's like allergic to humor. I mean, there's never any, you know, moments that make you smile.
It never stops.
Outside of, you know, is that a fucking e-cigarette? I mean, that is the only line that's like, you know, to me, that's like, I mean.
And that's kind of what makes Volcaro the main reason the show has even worked to a certain extent, because some of the lines he's been given, the quirky, you know, aspect of this character, are kind of enjoyable.
Yeah, like what was what I like how his character's written, because, you know, I get to see some of the less offensive Dick Pizzolatto. Like, what is it, you know, the models, right, where he walks in with Annie and it's like, you know, hey, you know, so you build models. Like, yeah, I built them with my son, and, you know, then I started building with Adam. I'm like, that's an interesting line, but, you know, it still isn't the same. It doesn't make me chuckle or anything.
Yeah, it's like he's quirky. That's the best way to put it. He has some quirks that are kind of interesting, idiosyncrasies, and I think, you know, Colin Farrell's done a great job with them. And then every other character, they're well acted, and he means well behind the creation of the characters. But, like, take Annie, for example, you know, Rachel McAdams, like I said, she is as good of an actress as anything you'd possibly find on television.
She might be the worst written character in the show, though. Best acted, worst written.
So I said this after episode one. I thought she seemed like, to a certain degree, she was introduced as the overreaction to all of Pizzolatto's, like, critics, you know, like the way they treat female characters in the first season. So I was like, okay, I want everything every critic ever said to me, I'm going to create, you know, the one character. But now she's a one-note character because that's her character so far.
Yeah.
Between three episodes, she has not had much growth or interesting aspect other than she is the antithesis to what, you know, critics were saying season one.
I won't even go as far as saying critics. I mean, it's just, you know, she's just a strong female character, and Nick Pizzolatto decided, hey, I'm going to try and squeeze one of those in. But like I said, I think Rachel McAdams has done the best with what she's been given. You know, like I said, I think she's the best acted but worst written. But let's go ahead and turn to the other side, where I think he's the worst acted but probably the best written in Frank Simeon.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's a very fascinating subplot that could be going on here with Vince Vaughn's character. And I just think that it was a complete misstep to cast Vince Vaughn in this role compared to, I mean, or maybe he cast Vince Vaughn and then wrote the role. I'm not entirely sure, but it's like, I don't see a marriage in terms of the role and the actor. You know, I think, like, last episode, the monologue was kind of interesting at the beginning of season, you know, episode two. He had that interesting monologue.
But it was still a piece. It was still a crappy monologue.
I'm being kind. When I say interesting, I'm just saying it was interesting, the idea of it. It was like, okay,
I love the idea of a, you know, showrunner giving that line to someone. I love that idea. I love that, you know, in a vacuum, someone would be able to pull that off. Whether that someone's on Earth or even exists or is in the budget of this show is another question. But
definitely the budget. They could get pretty much whatever they want for the budget. It's just kind of.
I was just saying, like, I'm trying to think. Bryan Cranston could pull it off, but, like, a deep, dark, brooding, you know, John Hamm could pull it off. But, like, I'm trying to think that, you know, I don't think Vince Vaughn is the same kind of guy, which I'm saying that we're talking two episodes back, but, like, I thought he had some of the best moments that the character's ever had from an acting perspective. But even then, you know, we're still kind of seeing Vince Vaughn's, I don't know, he's hitting his ceiling. He's flirting with his ceiling every single episode. And that's both excellent and both kind of concerning because, you know, you want to see a little more. And frankly, the fist fighting scene at the end is more. I thought that was a scene that, you know, he very believably played someone who's pissed off. And that's great, and I appreciate that. I don't know. There was some strength, I guess. All of this is to say that I thought Vince Vaughn showed off some stuff. She showed something to me this.
But it's less about whether Vince Vaughn, because Vince Vaughn, we know Vince Vaughn's a good actor. That's not really the issue here, you know. I just think
he's
funny.
He's just not best for the roles, what you're saying.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, you have a character who's, you know, great in very comedic moments. Especially he's great with, you know, physical acting, whether it's from humor or the reason that, you know, fighting scene was so effective. Because he is a tall, big guy who can be an intimidating presence. I think that was kind of the idea. But having some guy, you know, struggling with doubt, you know, and his, drama going on in the bedroom. Like, why is this character who could be so much more, so kind of depressing and empty to a certain degree? You know,
the word is diminished. He's diminished.
Diminished. Yeah, I just have some problems. Like, I think Vaughn could have been better. And I think a better actor could have been in this role from what he wants the role to be, but they also could have written this role better for Vince Vaughn. And considering that Simeon's gotten arguably the most screen time of any of the different characters so far, I still don't really understand how Simeon connects to the overall story in terms of, like, what Woodrow, for example. Like, it's interesting because they're all kind of based off the same kind of aspect, same thing, but so far through three episodes, there's barely any connection between the different characters.
What are you talking about, man? Woodrow bumped into Simeon at a club. That's all the connection we need, right? No, I understand. And probably that's... And we're probably overreacting with Vince Vaughn and his, you know, fit, because we have seen him the most. We see an unreasonable amount of him. Some of that has been great, but, you know, almost a majority of it has been kind of eh. I'm gonna be a proponent for him because I don't think he's been terrible. The kind of mediocre moments have offset the greatness that we've seen in him, I think.
I think don't take my what I'm saying as criticism of Vince Vaughn.
Know that when we say Vaughn, we mean his performance. I understand.
Yeah, I just don't like the way this show has handled him so far. Like, I'm gonna just keep watching. I didn't hear the best things about the first three from, like, you know, the releases to the critics, so I'm not entirely surprised, but at this point, if the fourth episode doesn't really hook me, then I'm not going to be hooked in this show, period. And I think, you know, season one, while I didn't love the first three episodes, I thought they were good, and then the fourth episode is really what drew me in, and I loved the fifth one, and then, you know, the rest of the way, but I think through three episodes here, this has been at best average to a certain degree, maybe above average with production value, but also antagonizingly hard to watch. In terms of what it's going for, you know, the message and the story of this, the vision of this show. And if it doesn't start, you know, bringing some cohesiveness or some connection between different characters, I don't really know if I want to watch this every Sunday night. You know, it's getting kind of hard.
And the only reason why I'm a little sour on this is because there is a lot of good TV on right now, or at least some stuff that's just started that's kind of going by the wayside. I'm, you know, chiefly talking about Mr. Robot, which is the, it's USA Network, excuse me. Humans is the AMC one. Both of those have been pretty good. Even Halt and Catch Fire has, you know, been, critics have, you know, shown some pretty good confidence in it. And those are three shows that I'm not watching because of all this time I was spending on True Detective. And it's ultimately, you know, been pretty, it's been good, but it's just, you know, the amount of time I'm spending in it compared to the amount of enjoyment I'm getting on it could be better.
I don't even know if as an overall product it's good or not. But by the way, Simeon, mm-hmm. I think certain aspects obviously, but Simeon, right? I have a question. What exactly is his enemy right now? Himself? Is that what the overall direction would be? Maybe it's him the whole time? You know, man versus man? I don't know. Like, I'm man versus self. I don't really know what his enemy is here.
I think that's
another issue of the show.
Hey, Vince. Hey, how's it going, Nick? All right, I got this role for you. So, you are a businessman. A good businessman turned bad. Now, that sounds interesting. Whose biggest enemy is himself? Tell me more. Tell me more. No, I mean...
So, real quick, so remember we talked about Nicolas Cage a couple weeks back? We were like, okay, how would Nicolas Cage do this role? I want you to tell me how you think Nicolas Cage would do this role.
Not much different, only instead of in the fight, he gets his ass beat. I mean, just using this episode as a barometer, I think that Nick Cage doesn't beat a fat Filipino man in a fight.
I think Jared Leto,
Jared Leto would like be on the ground and then like, you know, he's just only getting more wiry and he's just like, you know, I don't know. Jared Leto to me is a guy that like, I think I was winning and then he like kind of turns on some switch.
I just feel like Jared Leto, like the monologue about the rats, whatever, you know, he would have like went into a locked cellar for a couple of days with no food with rats as he prepared for that role. So you see in that monologue, you still have like bite marks on him from when he did that to prepare for it. Like,
is it
I don't know.
Is it just me or is Jared Leto just a more angsty version of Jake Gyllenhaal?
He's like if Jake Gyllenhaal really, really, really wanted to be not just a method actor, but really like evolve into that character. I don't know. It's like, I feel like Jared Leto's going to have some really weird story one of these days that I can believe almost anything about him and how he prepares for roles.
Is it strange that, like, I identified Jared Leto more as a singer than I, like, I was a, you know, above average 30 Seconds to Mars fan. And that's how I know Jared Leto. I don't, and, like, people are telling me he's an actor. He's like, he sang a couple songs. I mean, look, it came up on shuffle on my iPod.
I mean, who doesn't love The Kill?
I mean, The Kill's great. I really like what is it called? Kings and Queens. That's the one.
other songs by him.
Closer to the Edge is great.
Attack.
Attack.
This is War is another one.
I'm gonna Google this because it's the drum line. We can move on while I figure this out.
Okay, it's funny. We're both, you know, early 90s kids being born, you know, I understand. I like 30 Seconds More. I don't love them. I don't hate them. I kind of like them. I think that's probably the opinion of every one of them.
I mean, they're just like, it's like Fall Out Boy, My Chemical Romance, Panic at the Disco, and, you know, 30 Seconds to Mars is kind of lumped in sometimes. I mean, it's just kind of that same emo punk genre, and you know, 30 Seconds to Mars is just one of those bands that everyone's heard of, I think.
You know, I enjoy all these conversations so much more than thinking about True Detective, which I guess is my current stance. It's not that it's bad.
Really good. Not what I'm thinking, but A Beautiful Lie is pretty cool.
It's not that True Detective is bad so far. It's not that, you know, it might even be above average. It's just not fun to watch, and it hasn't, you know, it's not cohesive in any regard to a certain degree. And yeah, some elements are cool, but I just need more. And I guess that's my final stance right now after 3 episodes, and I don't know. I guess I'll give it one more, you know, one more when it comes on live type watching.
Probably gonna watch it. I mean, I'm in too. It's a lot like with Walking Dead. I mean, I'm in too far to just kind of quit. Although
that's a different.
Although I'm only one and a half seasons in, not even. This is kind of a different thing.
But I feel like if I don't watch True Detective, I'm failing as a TV viewer, and I've already failed in, like, not watching Mad Men, so I kind of have to do this.
I think Battle of One is the 30 Seconds to Mars song I'm thinking about.
All right, well, on to something a little more interesting.
It's got a cool drum beat, that's all.
I actually play drums. Did you know that stuff?
I mean, I play drums too, just not professionally. Or with any kit in prison. I mean, just give me two things and that resemble sticks and give me, you know, five things that I can hit, and, you know, I'm a drummer too.
The first thing I learned, which I would play all the time while I was, like, in boarding class, was Dance Dance, the opening.
That's, you know, snare, bass, you know.
Yeah, really, pretty much, yeah. It's a lot of fun to just play in class. But anyways, moving on. So Han Solo, you know, he's getting his own movie because we're going to have a lot of different movies about, I think, you know, Boba Fett's going to have a movie. Star Wars is like, hey, you know, Marvel makes a lot of money. We own Marvel and we own Star Wars now. That's what Disney's thinking. So it's like, okay, let's make Star Wars like Marvel. Eventually, everyone's going to get super sick of all these different movies. I don't know when that'll be. I think there's a lot of love for Star Wars right now because it's kind of like, oh, I'm tired of superheroes. Yay, Star Wars.
I tend to agree, if not for the fact that they're actually getting some good people to head these movies. I mean, I like J.J. Abrams personally. I think that he's about as good as a guy you can get to run that Star Wars movie. And then the guys that they announced for this Han Solo movie, Christopher Miller and Phil Lord, who, you know, gave us Lego Movie and Jump Street. And by that alone, I mean, they're pretty much, they're a big deal. And if, you know, a Han Solo movie kind of uses those same sensibilities, that same kind of, you know, that rhythm, that same kind of, you know, tone, I really appreciate it. I mean, that's the kind of character Han Solo is. He's, you know, a lovable rogue, and, you know, that's kind of what 21 Jump Street and 22 Jump Street are all about, is two lovable rogues, and, you know.
I'm as big of a fan of the 21 and 22 Jump Street as they come, and obviously we both love Lego Movie. Now, I'm very excited to see what they do. It's like, that's the problem. It's like, Han Solo movie, I guess that would be cool, but then it's like, you know, I want to see it, but it's also like I'm kind of tired of the way they spin off everything, but it's like, okay, the directors are great. The writer's like, okay, I guess I have to, you know,
well,
I guess I have to.
I'm just saying that they could throw, there's a person they could throw that in there that I would feel exactly the same way you do. But because, you know, like I said, there's just enough resources to go ahead and sit there and say, okay, well, you know, this is well within the realm of possibility and could be pretty good. My one thing, though, is, you know, Lord and Miller, if they do this Han Solo movie, there's a good chance that we won't see 23 Jump Street. I think they were also on tab to do a Flash movie. We won't see that. So I'm kind of, you know, is a Han Solo movie worth losing a potential Flash movie and a 23 Jump Street movie? Probably not, but, you know.
You mean Men in Black in 21 Jump Street, right?
Men in Black's an interesting one. You know, total digression here. Men in Black's really interesting. I think that the first one is great and is this good canvas. The second one was bomb. The third one almost fixed it.
I actually never saw the third one because
you never saw the third
like,
one. Okay.
Because I watched the first two, and then after the second one, I was like, I don't really want to watch the third one now.
The third one's interesting. It's better than the second one, which isn't saying that much. It's like saying Iron Man 3 was better than Iron Man 2. I mean, it's like, it was good, but, you know, is it? It was better, but, like, what kind of heights did it have to climb to get there?
I heard the best part was Josh Brolin essentially pretending to be Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Like, I don't know. I thought it was very good. I'll just, you know, quit the corner cutting. I can honestly say that, you know, Men in Black 3 was really cool. It was a really cool movie and probably a little underrated, but it's not breaking any, you know, it's not breaking any records or anything.
Well, I like Men in Black 1 a lot, and I love, you know, the ride at Universal Studios. You ever been there before?
I have not, no.
Okay, so they have this, like, ride. It's pretty much like the Buzz Lightyear ride at Disney World where, like, you shoot the different...
I've never been to Disney World.
Okay, well, anyway, so you shoot... You have, like, a little cart, and you have a gun, you
There's
shoot
There's a ride
little, like,
called Men in Black. Just, that's
yeah.
All.
My point is, I've been on that ride so many times, I actually know, like, the, like, how to, like, get, like, super high scores on that ride. And that's my main connection to Men in Black at this point in terms of, like, what I think about it. Like, I think about the ride, not the movie, not the series. Anyways...
Yeah, it's interesting, but, you know, what was the connection?
Oh, the Han Solo movie. They made 21 Jump Street, 22 Jump Street, the directors, and they also, you know, might do a spinoff with Men in Black. That's the connection. Oh, we can move on. There's not too much really new
to say. I didn't know I probably did know, but didn't know that they did the Men in Black movie.
No, they didn't do the Men in Black movie. They just, they might
do
a spinoff.
Why are we talking about it?
I told you, 21, 22 Jump Street, the 21 Jump Street's going to do a spinoff with Men in Black. Like, that's going to be a combined movie.
That's a terrible idea.
Yeah, that's what I started off this conversation with. Like, did you hear that? It was such a bad idea that it went, like, over your head.
I guess. But okay. I mean, will I watch it? I don't know. We'll see.
Look, I trust everything involving 21 Jump Street at this point. Because, like, I think I would watch every single one of those movies at the ending of 22 Jump Street. I would watch every single one of them. I really would. I don't know. Anyways, moving on.
I think the Han Solo movie will be interesting. They got as good a guy they could get. And, you know, we'll see from there.
So I got really excited. We talked about the different, you know, Hall of Fame nominees we did last week. One thing I really enjoyed was talking.
Total gear shift.
Yeah, you know, moving on. But I really enjoyed talking about the different video games. Our conversation about Majora's Mask, for example, you know. So I figured since Dave is not here, you and me, the bigger video games, you know, people of the three of us, I figured we'd just talk about what kind of some of these games and what makes them great, like some of our favorite games that we've played, and I guess why we enjoy them, because I think with a lot of games coming out in the new gen this fall and next spring, they're going to be some of the best of the generation. You can argue like some of the best game generation just came out this last month.
More so, I guess the better way of putting it would be that this generation is forming. And,
yeah, it's
you know,
starting.
We don't which, you know, this generation is really forming, and we're seeing what games are going to, you know, consist of, you know, the Xbox mm-hmm. One, PlayStation 4 generation. Which kind of means, you know, the old generations are going to be put on the back burner. So let's go ahead and give in memoriam to those, I think.
So I want to start off with N64, I guess. What's one of the games you think is the defining N64 games, the size of Majora's Mask?
Come again?
Like, what's a defining N64 game, which is kind of like the first console I really played, that you think about besides, obviously, Majora's Mask?
Well, you know, Majora's Mask, Ocarina is a defining moment, you know, just in games in general, even if I personally think that Majora's Mask is better, but I know people...
And you're wrong.
I know people disagree with me, but, you know, it is what it is. I think people overrate Ocarina.
Ocarina is one of those games where it's like, it's kind of like Super Mario 64, except I find Super Mario 64 did, like, not really age at all, because you can't really age platformers to a certain degree, but... When Ocarina of Time came out, it was so momentous, you know, for what that game was, you know, in the time frame.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if the argument is that Ocarina is better for its time than Majora's Mask is for it, then, I mean, I don't disagree with that. But, you know, in terms of making a design decision and, you know, having it pay off, almost Majora's Mask made a lot of bold decisions that paid off. And that's kind of where I come from when I say it's a better game, is that, you know, you take this canvas being Ocarina and you add some certain elements. So it's basically Ocarina of Time.
Well, that's a different, we don't really need to get into this. It's a different, what's the best Zelda game?
But I'm using this to kind of set up my, you know, kind of what I see is great in games is when, you know, how do you present problems to a player and how do they overcome that? And what does the game give you as, you know, tools at your disposal to overcome these challenges? You know, Super Mario 64 is a good example. You know, and even look at Super Mario Sunshine, which, you know, it's, you know, you have this other element, but, you know, Super Mario 64 does well within its own skin. And I'm not saying Super Mario Sunshine's better, but that's a kind of a good example of a choice that changes how you approach the world and its problems.
I think one interesting thing about the different Zelda games is they never... Ocarina of Time was made, right? And obviously that was more of the, you know, grand adventure, multiple temples. Not exactly a dark game, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it was not exactly a lighter tune. But it also didn't go in the complete opposite direction of, like... Majora's Mask is almost like the Twin Peaks of video games, to a certain degree, if you want to classify as that. And Wind Waker is completely on the other end of the spectrum than Ocarina of Time. So what's interesting is then they made Twilight Princess, which is, you know, more of the Ocarina of Time, you know, realm, and it didn't work as well, which I found kind of interesting. And Skyward Sword's main flaw is the Wii Remote's awful. I'm going to say that right now. The Wii Remote controls are awful. It's why Super Mario Galaxy is kind of limited to the potential of what that game could have been. But it's interesting because of all the different series, Zelda is one where the three, in my opinion, best games all came out back to back to back, and they're not really that similar at all.
Yeah, and, you know, I disagree with anyone who says that. Well, you could even say the best four Zelda games came out back to back to back to back, because right before Ocarina was Link to the Past.
Link to the Past. You know, have you played Link Between Worlds?
I have not, no. My 3DS has kind of been gathering rust. The last game I bought for it was the Majora's Mask remake, and before that was Fire Emblem Awakening. So, 2 10s, I'm kind of, I'm definitely in the market to buy another 3DS game, but I've got enough on my plate right now between The Witcher 3 and Dark Souls 2.
Dark Souls 2.
and even Halo, I do want to kind of, you know, buckle down and go through the rest of those campaigns. I'm starting 3 next time I put the game in my Xbox.
So it's interesting because, like, Super Mario 64, I remember that was the first game I ever played, and I watched my mom play it. I saw her beat Bowser when I was 4, and I thought it was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But that game was interesting because it was one of the, you know, from the way the platforming genre kind of took over the N64 era, because every game then, and on the GameCube, was a platformer, and then every, like, spin-off, like, you know, commercialized game, like, if there's a Rugrats game, it's a platformer. You know, like, if there's a movie tie-in, it's a platformer. Like,
I've actually played... that Rugrats game, now that I think about it.
What was it, like Castle's Capers or whatever it's called?
I can't even remember. I also played the Rocket Power game for GameCube and remember liking it a lot.
Let's see, I just pulled it up. It's Royal Ransom, that's what it's called. You had the different, like, worlds or whatever, and Tommy was riding the, on Magic Carpet. Yeah, I played that game. Anyways, that's the thing. Like, essentially, that was kind of set, but Super Mario 64 is what set it, and in my opinion, it was the best one for what it did, because you had these worlds, and there's one, you know, there's stars you can go for, but you weren't tied to a very linear objective, right? Like, yeah, there's a point you want to go to, but it's an open world you can explore. And I would all the time routinely get stars out of order if I saw them, you know, before I got to it. And that was one thing that I was special about.
Well,
the
yeah,
game
I mean,
was...
it's like going into the Bob-omb world and getting the Chain Chomp star before the
yeah.
one you're actually supposed to get.
Yeah, that's actually the first one I usually get every time, actually, because I knew it was there. It's an easy one, yeah. And that's kind of the cool thing about that game. And I think the way you had the different worlds, and you could actually, you know, okay, I only need this number of stars. I don't have to get them from any given world, any given area, any given secret. I just need that number, and I'm given the freedom to choose it. And that's the thing, is like, Super Mario Galaxy, which I just played, some people said it was the best game of last generation. And I think while it's, in terms of its design and innovation, uniqueness, art style, it's all, you know, exemplary, and it's amazing. But the problem with that game is the levels felt so linear to me in terms of my objective, what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that compared to... And that's, you know, that's a choice. I mean, I just don't like that as much in comparison to what Super Mario 64 brought us in these giant worlds, or Banjo-Kazooie, or Donkey Kong 64.
I know. The design choice of linearity is one that's... It's a delicate balance, because I think... Unpopular opinion here, I think Skyrim does it the wrong way, to where the less linear you are... Your world becomes less inviting and more, you know, intimidating. And that's... that's...
Oh.
And like I said, that's an unpopular opinion, but that's, you know... what that's kind of... When you make something linear, it's a correction for being overly intimidating and, you know, having too much choice. Because too much choice is a bad thing. Unless you can... And, you know, there are rare instances of people, you know, creating very solid open-world games that, you know... a good way to handle it is the way Zelda does, to where you can't access certain points because you need certain tools. But that still means the first time going through, hey, you know, this is something I can't get to, but it has a little target on it. All right, well, as soon as I have something to give me, you know, as soon as I have the hook shot, I can probably come back to that and have rewards. And it's to me, that's kind of, you know, there are right ways and wrong ways to introduce you to an open world. Fallout's one that's kind of a rare example to where it's, like, completely open and, you know, it's not... as intimidating, just because it's a, you know, it's a much more interesting world, I feel, than Skyrim. But, you know, I never played Super Mario Galaxy, so I can't really say how it relates.
So I have 3 points off that, which one I thought was very interesting when you said that. One thing that makes Link Between Worlds so great is, yeah, you need the hookshot to get to a temple, right? But you can do any of the temples in any order, and they let you rent the items that you need for those given temples.
Mm-hmm.
So you have complete choice over what items you want, or what temples you want to go to in any order, which is really cool in terms of, like, the, you know what you need to do that, but you gotta take your choice. But I'm kind of, you know, I agree with you in the idea that Fallout 3 is more interesting than Skyrim, which is not that different from the average, any day, you know, medieval fantasy world open design. But I love Skyrim because of the massive amount of content and freedom to what you can do. And yeah, there's a lot of objectives, but it's also, like, I enjoyed, you know, doing, like, the Thieves Guild and working my way up to the Thieves Guild, doing those different missions. I enjoyed, you know, having, being an assassin and murdering people in one of the guilds.
Yeah,
you know,
but that's where I kind of, you know, make the distinction. I mean, freedom is different than just, you know, being open world.
I just think if you... It depends, like, if you're one of the kind of person who can handle... And I say, sometimes we need instruction, you know? And, like, the way society even works to a certain degree is we want people to tell us what to do. That's why we have all these different rules and the different guidelines and different everything. Like, because we want people to tell us what we're supposed to do in given situations. A game like Skyrim, it's like, okay, have fun. Outside of, like, the, you know, we have a main quest, but that's only, you know, a small portion of that game. And you do, to a certain degree, have to do things outside that main quest in order to level up, in order to do, you know, the main quest. And that's something you see in pretty much every game. And it's interesting because compared to The Witcher 3, which is, you know, multiple maps within the world, like, you have a different, like, segment areas. Even if you can get from one segment area to the other one, like, without having to, like, you know, go to a loading screen or anything, Skyrim is just one giant world, period.
Yeah, and that's... It deserves achievement for that, so...
I love Skyrim. I know a lot of people who don't like that game, but I love that game. It's kind of like No Man's Sky, which is coming out. It's a very fascinating game because of the size and scope of it, but I don't know what you can actually do in that world. And maybe that's how some people feel with Skyrim, which I love. I want to reiterate, I love Skyrim. It's probably one of my 3 or 4 favorite games from last generation, but it's interesting because, like, in terms of, like, a pure linear gameplay game, like The Last of Us, I love The Last of Us. I love the emotional resonance that game gives off. You know, obviously it's probably really similar in linearity to, like, the Uncharted series, which you've played, which I'm actually currently playing. But
and every time I say how good Uncharted 3 is, I get told to shut up because it's not better than Last of Us.
I know, but it's more for fun, more for jokes. I'm more just messy when I say that, but then what I'm trying to say is,
but you know, from where I'm sitting, I think Uncharted's a good reason. You know, it is linear, but it encourages. You know, there's encouragement to go off the beaten path, and you know, in the form of the trophies, and you know, there's a right way. Like I said, there's a right way and a wrong way to break off linearity, and some games do it better than others. Uncharted, I mean. Uncharted is very linear. There is a reward for breaking off the beaten path, but even then, I mean, it's a very story driven game. I mean, it's kind of a hard comparison.
It's like when I think of games, though, like that's my favorite single player experiences I've had, right? You know, the only game I can say, like, because my favorite ones usually end up being like Fallout 3, Skyrim, you know, GTA 5, and that's kind of what I think about. And the only ones that really exceed without that, you know, without the boundary, either A, you know, Portal, which is not, which is a puzzle game that's a linear puzzle game, but still a puzzle game. So it's kind of unlike every other thing, you know, I've played in that regard. But, or like, you know, The Last of Us, which I think, I don't know if a game can be better for what it was trying to do than what The Last of Us was. And yet, the peak of that still isn't as high as some of these, you know, open world games. And that's kind of interesting, like the degree, like I said, Super Mario 64 versus, you know, one of the more modern, like, you know, 3D world. I don't know if you've played that at all, or 3D Land on the 3DS.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's the idea is like, yes, kind of the old school, like, okay, here's point A, get to point B, and there's a lot you could do with that, a lot of uniqueness, but I guess I like the freedom of choice and the freedom of options of what I want to do, and that's why, again, like, you know, Link Between Worlds is so special, is you take the, you know, roadmap of what make, you know, a game like Link to the Past so memorable, and you really expand upon that.
Yeah, and even, you know, Arkham City is one that I think does it a very similar fashion, not necessarily to Link Between Worlds, because that sounds like something that's very unique. But Arkham City's one, you know, it's a lot like Zelda, right? Where I pass by something that I don't have the tools to, you know, handle right now, but don't worry, you know, I can come back. But I also think that Arkham City in particular does a good job of, you know, here's where your next objective is. What you do on your way is up to you. And some,
I think Arkham City was fascinating because, like, while you're doing things, like, you might pick up on a phone call of Zaz, and then you'll have to, like, you have X amount of time to get to the location to answer the phone.
Yeah.
Before, you know, Zass, and then he gives a little monologue. Or, you know, you'd, like, Deadshot, like, you'd happen to pass with Deadshot. That's kind of interesting the way they did the side quest. That game was interesting, though, too, as well, because the overarching, you know, you had the countdown going on at all times, 8 hours or whatever the guy said every time, you know, which was kind of interesting. And I do like those aspects in games where it's like, this is the main mission, but I don't... And, like, Witcher 3, what you're going to realize is before the ending of Act 2, right... Whether you did all those, you could have an opportunity to go back and do all the side quests because they really do matter. And I actually ended up doing all those side quests before I got to that moment that wanted me to go do them all. So I didn't have to, like, it was super quick back for me because I'd already done all the side quests and stuff it wanted me to do before that point. And I liked the way that I was able to do that and then be, you know, ready instead of having to go back and do it, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I don't really have anything groundbreaking to add. You kind of summed it up.
Yeah, and just think of, like, the way evolution of certain series, like, Diablo 3 is one of my favorite games on the next-gen console, you know, the way Old Medieval Edition. I didn't actually like Diablo 3 in itself that much, but I love what it did in the Old Medieval Edition with the expansion, but also how they kind of changed the interface of the game and how it worked. And I beat that game in hardcore mode, which is one of the more interesting experiences I've ever had.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, being terrified the whole time I played through, or one of my friends dying. Luckily, none of us did, even though that last boss fight, you know.
I'm in a strange place when it comes to the Ultimate Medieval Edition. I own it, but anything that I can do on there would be retreaded territory, because I've already beaten it on PC 10 times over. Same thing.
But the idea, yeah, the thing is, like, that game, right, that's kind of like the dungeon crawler-esque game that you don't see that often.
Yeah,
and it's kind of interesting because, like, I think the one thing that I've really enjoyed about video games is the ones that I think that are more unique and diverse tend to be the ones that become more memorable. I mean, Sunset Overdrive I think had some flaws, but at least it was, you know, different, and that's kind of what made it special.
The Borderlands series is a good example to me because, you know, at its root it's just another shooter. At its root it's just another shooter. You know, at its root it's just another RPG. Whatever you want to say, it's not really that groundbreaking in terms of actual game design. It's well put together, but it's not really groundbreaking. But, you know, it introduces you to this world full of personality. And that, to me, is, you know, when you do everything right and pay attention, you earn the right to, you know, throw a little joke every now and then, you know, have Claptrap exist. Yeah, it's stuff like that. And
Do you remember Claptrap's birthday party?
Yeah. Oh boy, I must not have invited everyone. And like the pizza, and, you know, go ahead, Min, you need a slice of this. You can get it. Borderlands is interesting too, because
or his secret stash, which is like literally right in front of you. Before you can get into my secret stash, though, you must brave the great giant and face 1,000 lions. Or like all the ridiculous things he said, whatever. And my favorite was in one of the DLCs, because Borderlands 2 is kind of why I had the reason I don't like Destiny to one degree, but two, it's like the DLC was so well done for that game. I think my favorite was being like a Dungeons and Dragons-esque, you know, DLC. And at one point, he was like, "Minions, go get me a beard, because every great wizard needs a beard. So your job's to get Claptrap the Wizard a beard."
Yeah.
And I don't know, I really do love those games. Because right, I think the one thing is, like, you have games like Far Cry. I enjoy Far Cry 3 a lot. I enjoyed Far Cry 4 a lot. But I can't say I'm super excited about a game like Far Cry 5 to a certain degree. I'm not that excited about any of the Call of Duties when they're coming out. And even Arkham Knight, I have, like, some, like, you know, leniency toward because I hate Origins and I feel like I've done it a lot. That's why Halo doesn't excite me that much compared to the games. Comparatively, I see, you know, State of Decay, you know, the Survival Edition, I really can't wait to play that because of what State of Decay is compared to every other game.
Yeah, I agree. Far Cry is one that I actually never really got to. I kind of skipped to the old generation.
So you want to hear something interesting. Far Cry 2 is, in my opinion, as opposite as what Far Cry 3 and 4 are, I think, especially Far Cry 4. I think Far Cry 2 is as opposite as Far Cry 4 as it possibly could be. Far Cry 4 is an open world that wants you to explore, but it's also very accessible, right? Like, the game does not want to be that difficult, and it wants to give you to be able to do a bunch of different things, but it doesn't want to make it hard for you. You know, they want, you know, kind of introduce this world kind of, you know, slowly, nicely, and while there's some weird, trippy stuff, for the most part, it's a really fun game, but it's not, you know, groundbreaking, it's just fun.
Yeah.
Far Cry 2
yeah.
wants to punish you. Far Cry 2 is like, okay, you know, you're a mercenary in a war-torn area, and you have malaria, so you have to take malaria pills every X amount of time. So I had this mission, I quit playing the game, because I had this mission that was like on the other side of the area. By the time I could get that drive there, I had to drive immediately back if I didn't want to die of malaria. And then, the respawns in that game, every enemy would respawn so ridiculously quickly. And it's considered one of the most punishing, you know, unique games of its time. Some people love it. I can't stand that game for what it is. And then you have Far Cry 4, which is nothing like Far Cry 2. Far Cry 3 is also nothing like Far Cry 2 in that regard.
Yeah. I wish I had more to contribute, but, I mean, Far Cry was a series I quite literally have no idea.
And it's interesting because right now, one thing you're seeing heavily is the MOBA industry, which obviously, you know, a lot, or even just free-to-play, which Hearthstone was so successful that Legends is the new one by Bethesda based off the Elder Scrolls series. You know, there's going to be a MOBA, I think, for every, like, Microsoft will have their own MOBA at some point. Sony will have their own MOBA.
Hearthstone's not really a MOBA, but,
Well, I mentioned two. No, I said there's MOBAs and free-to-plays. That's two different things when I started off saying
sure.
this. Yeah, no, I'm saying, like, you have those two different markets. Like, I think, like, yeah, you're going to see every console have their own MOBA, but you're also going to see more and more games, kind of like Hearthstone, or just free-to-play models similar to what Hearthstone is in terms of how successful it was.
Yeah, really, MOBAs and, you know, the card games like Hearthstone. Hearthstone's a really interesting case just because of, gosh, Blizzard has the resources to, you know, make that thing what it is and keep it, you know, constantly, you know, constantly changing meta. That's something that's always tough with card games, and Hearthstone is doing a great job at that, I think. You know, the MOBA market's really interesting because I'd argue that, the MOBA market is what makes PC gaming the single best, you know. Anyone that says that console gaming's better, I mean, there's probably more choices on a console, but in terms of how many people are playing, I mean, more people are playing PC MOBAs than anything else. And, you know, you look at how many subscribers League of Legends has. Smite's getting up there, too.
More people play League of Legends or Dota 2 than Xbox One, Wii U, Sony combined, you know, PlayStation 4 combined.
Yeah, which is like, one of the reasons, yeah. Which is one of the reasons I know that we had this talk with Brian a while ago about, you know, how now more people are playing consoles. I'm just like, I've seen those numbers. I think you're wrong. but, you know, a lot of it's because of that price tag attached to it. League of Legends is free to play. And then because of the in-game transactions, they, you know, make a lot of money too. Like, quite literally, they just need to take that initial hit. And now that it's established, Dota 2 was great because it already had a fan base for, you know, from the free-to-play game. And, you know, basically they turned something that wasn't making any money into something that's making a lot of money. And all it took was Valve to just say, hey, we'll pay for some of those things you need. but I don't
AKA have a company with a lot of money like Bell.
Yeah, and it's strange, like, when I haven't really, like I said, I've been moving, so I haven't really had a chance to really play a lot of Heroes of the Storm. You know, League of Legends I've stopped playing because when you have so many people playing something, it kind of turns itself to a toxic environment. but, you know, Dota does a better job of that because they initiate you a little more, that, you know, because of how it operates, there's less people less 12-year-olds calling you calling you a faggot or anything else. Heroes of the Storm's interesting. You can't talk to allies, so the toxic environment that you get sometimes when you play MOBA doesn't exist for Heroes of the Storm. But I don't know. It's interesting because I've kind of sidetracked a lot, I think. But now MOBAs are something that's growing. I don't see them slowing down at all. You know, the isometric view also makes it easy to spectate, so it's easy to, you know, make a super culture out of it. And that's something that I think that not very many people consider. But that's why I think Smite's a little hard to gauge in terms of how it's going to do in the MOBA market, just because, like I said, the great thing about Dota, League, Heroes of New Earth, even to a certain degree, is that they are. I mean, it's made for the spectator.
So I guess, like, the last thing I want to get into a little bit, you know, the success of MOBAs, I think, and the free-to-play model, what they have, is kind of why I don't know if we're going to really have any more, you know, outside of Blizzard, World of Warcraft, which is a never-ending beast, you know, that probably will never die and always be successful. I don't know if we're going to have many more subscription-based, you know, MMOs. You've already seen, you know, BioWare through their, you know, their best at it, and, you know, they end up being, you know, no longer subscription-based. Elder Scrolls Online did it. You know, now it's once you buy the game, it's free. You don't have to pay a monthly payment. And I actually don't really know if we're going to be seeing another giant company try their hand at an MMO with a subscription-based, you know, fee, because I just don't think it works. And I think kind of what we've seen with why MOBAs are successful, I think people will buy the game with the MMOs. I don't think they want to actually pay any more thing after that when you have all these other free options.
And there are certain games that, you know, play around with that. Knights of the Old Republic is one that, you know, is free to play. I mean, there's many ways that different companies, BioWare did the whole, originally it was you buy the game and then it's a subscription. Now it's like a free to play, and you pay for like extra stuff, you know, just extra content, I guess is what it is. But, you know, you're more than welcome to travel the world. It's hard to say that it's not doing well. Just because they announced the new expansion, people are going to play the new expansion because that's just.
Well, it's more. I don't know if it's doing well or not.
Warlords of Draenor practically saved World of Warcraft, is why I'm saying expansions are, you know, it's a good publicity move sometimes.
I mean, I don't think. What I'm trying to say is, like, first of all, when it comes to Old Republic, they put so much. BioWare put so much money and capital into that series, you know? They are not going to give up on it that easily.
Well,
but with that.
As I was saying, though, too, I mean, you also have Guild Wars 2, one-time purchase, no subscription fee, it's just a one-time purchase.
That's how Guild War 1 was like that, too, though.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm just saying that many, many different companies are taking a different route at it. And in terms of a guy who's, you know, played a good number of MOBAs, I mean, there are some interesting ones. I'm trying to remember another
Wildstar
one.
Wildstar
was a flop.
Recent, yeah.
Wildstar was a flop. Final Fantasy 14 was good. It still runs by that subscription model, and I think it's doing all right, but, you know, it's still no World of Warcraft. World of Warcraft's in a really good place right now, just in terms of, you know, where the gameplay is. Blizzard's been doing this for almost 10 years now. They know what they're doing. I don't know. MOBAs are just interesting. If you're in the market for one, you know, it's the only game you'll play, and because of the variety of the experience, I mean, it's hard to argue that, you know, a MOBA doesn't deliver and you don't get your money's worth sometimes just because of what it offers.
Well, the thing is, like I said, MOBAs are pretty much, you don't have to pay any money if you don't want to for a MOBA at this, you know, current model. But the thing is, I put with the Smite, for example, Xbox One, I played like 80-ish hours into that in 1 month, you know, and I didn't get to play Witcher 3, and I was like, you know what, I can't play this anymore because it's literally taking up all my, you know, free time playing video games. I'm just playing this one game, and it definitely was, you know, worth it. But that's what's interesting, like, if I'm a person who doesn't have that much money to play a game, I could literally just spend all my time playing Smite. Why would I want to pay, you know, $15 a month to play another game?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I played League of Legends all through college. I mean, it's because it was free. I mean, I didn't have to do anything.
Yeah. All right. Let's get out of here because we've been here for a while. But I don't know. It's just I think I want to kind of visit later on. I guess you know maybe a couple months from now what the new games coming out. I guess how they reflect you know what the industry is moving toward. But I do think it's.
I prefer that open-ended discussion.
Yeah, I like thinking about the trends of like what exactly video games you know been going toward and you know what the new model is. I just it's interesting because this is the in some regards you know both consoles Xbox One and PS4 have sold better than any generation before them. You have. More and more companies are thriving compared to a lot of other industries that are dying. And AAAs just keep making more and more games, even when, you know, smaller industries aren't working. But even in the indies, there's so many people in the indie market, you're getting a lot of indies. So this is one of the best times to be a video gamer. I'm kind of curious to see if something like VR kind of changes everything or not.
And it looks like we lost Seth. But anyways, that's all we got for today's show. Anyways, I'm Billy White. That was Seth Juniac. Thank you for listening to White Noise Weekly. We'll be back next week with another episode.
We show entertainment stuff. Billy. Seth, David, and Billy, and David, and Seth, and Billy again. This is the best show in the entire world. Movies, TV, video games. Enjoy the show.